that you guys have, I'm sure, within, say, the hedge funds at Bear Stearns, the hedge fund manager, the famous, maybe infamous hedge fund managers at Bear Stearns, who talked about how they had to determine which AAA securities were real AAAs and which weren't. They were clearly claiming they were doing their job by parsing these AAAs. People like Greenberg, who was titular head of Bear Stearns at the time, or maybe he wasn't even titular head anymore, but certainly an influence there, and the other fellow were claiming that there were no serious distinctions. That, to me, is either extremely disingenuous or amazingly neglectful, but my point goes back to the Fed. Why didn't this raise red flags at the Fed? So it's not merely a matter of enforcing regulations clearly. It was a matter of abdication of oversight, oversight responsibilities that I think were ideologically based. Similarly, there was a very long history of negligence of specifically regulating derivatives, which you guys are well aware of.
Of course.
It didn't only begin with the famous, you know, battle with Brooksley Bourne in 1999. Congress and the Clinton administration did not choose to regulate in 1994 when there was, at least in the media, it tends to be forgotten. In fact, it wasn't even much of an event back then, but that was a while ago. In my memory, maybe one. How many brokerage firms took major hits in 1994 because of derivatives? And of course, the famous Procter and Gamble, and which was a Gibson greeting cards, or one of those greeting cards.
Yeah, Gibson
took major losses because they bought securities, I think, from Bankers Trust. It was by then no longer working, clearly under the purview of the Fed, and no longer, you know, and working really as an investment bank, not as a commercial bank. Since the late 80s. Those are some examples. There were clear-cut conflicts of interest in the ratings agencies. I think the Fed had every right to look at compensation practices given its oversight responsibilities, and I think there are severe, really severe, severely unfair, unethical, and in fact non-market practices that go on Wall Street that neither the SEC, the Fed, nor the CFTC were investigating under their normal oversight obligations. I hope that's a little bit helpful.
No, absolutely.
I hope I'm also not absolving Wall Street, so we should go back to that a little bit. But the primary issue to me is that it was the regulators.
Right.
Primary obligation.
Well, let's let's go back to Wall Street. You certainly hinted at untoward practices and perhaps illegal ones. But what other practices were you thinking of on Wall Street that led to this crisis?
Well, I think a lot of it has by now become public. I think the level of deception and fraud in the mortgage writing companies has become quite clear, but to the extent I've watched the hearings, it struck me that it hasn't been made very clear to the public, though I'm sure it's clear to you guys, that Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers were not only raising money in the securitization markets, they were also writing subprime mortgages. And Countrywide was also raising money in the securitization markets. In other words, they were both doing both. It strikes me that the major players, it could be the Goldman, had less of an operation than most of the others. And Merrill had an operation, but O'Neill bought a mortgage writing company, I forget which one. Could it have been New Century? No, not New Century, but another one. Rather late in the game. The idea, so they were... While so much of the publicity about the major prestigious investment banks and commercial banks has been about the securitization operations. They were very aggressive writers of what were probably fraudulent, but at least deceitful and unethical subprime mortgages as well. So that's one area I think that has not been adequately discussed.
And you're not talking about mortgage-related assets like CDOs and mortgage-backed securities, but literally
they sold mortgage-backed securities, as we know, aggressively, and that's gotten all the attention regarding the major investment banks and major commercial banks. But they also sold crummy subprime mortgages very aggressively to individuals through their mortgage writing subsidiaries. They fed each other. Mozilla was very determined to have the converse of that was Mozilla was ultimately writing subprime mortgages, and then developed a big capital markets operation to sell mortgage-backed securities to pension funds and banks and investment managers around the world. So these operations were doing both. That seems to me not to have attracted enough attention. When these guys get up and say they were just servicing their clients or just selling mortgage-backed securities to pension funds, they were selling them, but they were also using the money directly and indirectly to write really crummy mortgages. Right. And I think that hasn't received enough attention. Right. On the collateralized debt obligation issue, I think to this day economists don't fully understand how deceptive, at least I think, these collateralized debt obligations were. With the corroboration and reinforcement of the credit rating agencies. Again, I keep using the phrase, as you know, it's because I fear I'm simply repeating things you guys have thought about 100 times. But let me say what I believe. It was very clear in their minds that they were using a trick that became that was reinforced by the credit rating agencies to turn fairly bad mortgage bonds, not mortgages themselves, but the mortgages packaged into mortgage bonds, to change those mortgage bonds into AAA-rated tranches of these new CDOs. That was, to me, the most remarkable thing that went on Wall Street, and all these companies, maybe JPMorgan Chase did less of it, but all these companies participated, or most of these companies participated very aggressively, and why wouldn't they? There they were, they were making magic. And again, I come back to the Fed. As far as I can tell, Timothy Geithner, as head of the New York Fed, and his staff had no serious idea what was going on. And I'm a big fan of Bill Dudley as an economist. It is hard for me to believe he did not understand this was going on. When he took office, maybe he just never looked into it. But so I think that those are among the two most egregious practices on the parts of these people. When I hang up, I'll think of 15.
Sure. feel free to drop us a note after the talk if you think of something else.
When I talk to people, I made a speech at the University of Rome to progressive economists, and in fact, I blogged something for the New York Review of Books blog, and a bunch of people picked it up, and some of my friends picked it up, and they keep saying, "Well, I agree with you, Jeff, but the big issues were inequality of income and capital flows from overseas because of the high dollar, which kept interest rates low," which I believed was a major background issue in all of this. But I think they do not understand the level of deceit that may qualify as fraud, legal fraud, or that went on Wall Street, and what amounted to, in effect, a conspiracy on the part of the players on Wall Street to take advantage of investors. I do want to say one thing about investors, if I can.
Yes,
Matt, because the idea that somehow these guys are sophisticated, dispassionate players in the market, I also find remarkable. And I think the new re-regulation bills did not deal very much at all with the investor side. The implication that they are sophisticated investors and don't and don't need protection, I think has gotten pretty crazy. They make money, they invest in these things because they pay 1, 2, or 3% more. They make bonuses, the people who run these funds, the same way other people make bonuses. They kept playing the musical chairs and thinking they'd have a chance to get out before the music stopped, as that guy at Citigroup said. So I think there has to be serious attention turned to what motivates and incentivizes the guys who make investment decisions, because after all, they are big investors, but the people who they manage money for are often small people.
Right.
People with small investments, and that has to be seriously looked at, because I think they were complicitous in this as well.
Right. Let me ask you also about the role that the shadow banking system may have played in all this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people have pointed to that as one of the culprits here. Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, when I think. You know, there was a, let me just step back. I am talking about both the shadow banking system and the commercial banking system when I talked about some of these practices. Both of them were writing mortgages as well as selling mortgage-backed securities. But it was the shadow banking system that was given its head by the SEC, I forget whether it's 2003 or 2004, to leverage as much as they wanted to leverage. That was quite a serious issue, I think. The shadow banks now create money. They now do exactly what commercial banks and thrifts did. They create mortgages. And I think the lack of oversight was a main contributing factor to this, oversight in the sense that they too were, you know, even more than commercial banks to some degree, were writing CDOs like crazy, and nobody was seriously looking at them. I'm thinking mostly of investment banks in the shadow bank category, but a lot of people include hedge funds and even insurance companies like AIG in this process. So I think shadow banks and commercial banks have to be regulated in similar ways, and I think part of the spirit of the re-regulation bill was just that. What we don't have is the details, and I think all of it may founder when we get down to the details and the actual rule writing. That worries me a lot. But yeah, the lack of regulation of the shadow banks was serious. But when you see people like Citigroup becoming, in the mid-2000s, Citigroup, the two leaders in writing CDOs were Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, one a shadow bank, one a commercial bank. So after a while, there was after the late 1990s, there was really no distinction, and even before the late 1990s, there was really no distinction. The banks that were regulated did quite remarkable things because of the negligence of the Federal Reserve in following up on its investigatory practices.
Right.
The idea that these guys could put all that money into structured investment vehicles with no slap on the wrist by the Fed, that's something I forgot to mention. Another area of negligence is remarkable. I think, by and large, everybody had all the tools they needed except direct derivatives regulation, a credit default swap regulation. And one of the other well-publicized areas, of course, is Alan Greenspan's refusal to look more closely at mortgage writing, selling mortgages,
right,
subprime mortgages to individuals. That has to go pretty high on the list.
Right.
You know, my bottom line is most of the tools already existed.
Right.
The one extraordinary tool that didn't exist was that they were disallowed from regulating derivatives, from forcing derivatives on to exchanges. So the over-the-counter trading. I'm thinking that maybe I'm being too disorganized, but over-the-counter trading of derivatives was a major contributor to the crisis as well.
Sure.
The prices were set in obscurity, and there were no capital requirements for these guys. no requirements that they had to meet that we could meet their collateral obligations and pay off in the end. Another major contributor, another area in which the Fed probably and the SEC probably had the authority to take a stance and didn't bother. And certainly informally, they were determined to ignore it entirely based on free market ideology, I would call it.
Right. Let me say we're joined by my colleague, Adam Paul, who came in.
Hello.
While we were
Hi.
Talking. You were talking about Greenspan. In addition to these regulatory questions, some economists have pointed to his keeping interest rates low as one of the...
Is what? Say that again.
Some folks have pointed to Greenspan and the Fed keeping interest rates low for such a sustained period as one of the causes of this crisis.
Right.
Does that strike you as a...
It doesn't strike me as a primary issue, because with proper regulation, those low interest rates could have been quite salubrious. Given the lack of regulation and the lack of oversight, those low interest rates contributed significantly. But we were in quite an economy that was quite sluggish, and unemployment could have gone quite high. So it did not upset me that interest rates were pushed that low. Just to repeat, what upset me was they were pushed that low without regulatory oversight and regulatory implementation to restrain the excesses in the mortgage market. It is possible that Alan Greenspan pushed those rates lower, and I would write that it was, principally to reignite the mortgage market as the main engine of economic growth after that. I'm pretty sure he did do that. But he had no instinct or desire to be vigilant about all the bad mortgages that we create and all the risk-taking through the new complex, sophisticated, and obscure securitization process. I have been told, and I never double-checked this, that even the Fed did not have the right to look inside a collateralized debt obligation without taking on it, without making a special case of it. I don't quite know how that would have worked, but they should have made a special case of it. I don't think these guys have any idea what was going on there.
Right. So just to clarify, when you said earlier that you thought Geithner wasn't looking at that issue and had no awareness of what was going on, you think he should have. In other words,
I think it's
even if they didn't explicitly have the tools to look inside a CDO, they should have.
Yeah, I'm not. I think there might have been. I think they could have gotten around that if they insisted. I have no doubt they could have gotten around it. But there was something about how you had to be an investor in a CDO to know what was going on in the CDO. Now, I may have misinformation about that.
Sure.
But they could have gotten around that quite easily based on other other powers that they have, oversight powers. But I find it remarkable that I don't think they had any idea the nature of the riskiness of these CDOs, no idea whatsoever. And they, in turn, somehow seem to trust the credit rating agency's assessment of those. And the credit rating agencies were, by and large, as far as I can tell, getting their models from the investment banks who put the deals together. That can be investigated clearly, but I'm pretty sure they took their leadership from the investment banks. It's a quite remarkable period of regulatory negligence.
Right. Let's let me ask you about the housing bubble that was at the heart of so much of this. We've talked about the whole securitization and CDO part of the housing bubble, but are there other factors we should look at that? We've taken an examination of the GSEs, but other ways in which this bubble grew?
Well, I do think the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac contributed to this issue, to the problem. I don't think they were the primary mover. Recent information suggests they were big buyers of 10% of the bad securities by late 2007 being sold by Wall Street. So I do think that we can't ignore their role in all of this. But I think the housing and the housing were not the only loans securitized, as we know. Auto loans were securitized, credit cards were securitized. There was an enormous faith in the securitization process. So those all contributed to the financial architecture, which was so flimsy. The housing bubble, I note a lot of economists take credit for somehow predicting this collapse and recession. And I'm not sure any of them really deserve it. Maybe one or two do. The housing bubble was not per se the cause of the recession. It was the housing bubble caused this. It was the architecture of risky finance, extremely leveraged finance, built on flimsy housing credit that caused the crisis. Most economists who were worried about the housing bubble said, were talking about the reduction in the so-called wealth effect that kept consumption high because housing prices were high. And if housing fell, consumers would start spending less. They were not aware, I don't know any who are aware, maybe Rubini was in a generalized sense and a couple of others, but they were not aware of the extent, the flimsy extensive architecture of credit that was going to collapse and truly bring down the economy. So I think it was the housing bubble plus the securitization of other loans, the housing bubble, but the securitization process that led to the credit crisis.
Right. Sure, go ahead.
I must reemphasize the general complicity of the investors as well.
Right.
The pension funds, banks, and so forth. They were part of the same incentives process, compensation incentives process. And I hope you guys will turn some attention to them and why they bought into this craziness. I'd also like to say one other thing about the too big to fail notion, which I can't quite get my finger on it. People get better at it when they say, get more explicit and more clear about it when they talk about being too interconnected to fail. But the real systemic risk was herd, from my point of view, was herd behavior. Everybody was doing the same thing. Everybody was borrowing very, very heavily on the same damaged collateral. And that was the true systemic risk. Not merely that somebody was so big he could bring everybody else down. So I think it's a slightly different problem which requires addressing herd behavior, not just the size of financial institutions. It requires addressing herd behavior in terms of re-regulation, which should involve capital requirements, leverage, maximums, and maybe not breaking up institutions so much as forbidding them from doing certain activities a la the Volcker Bill.
Right. And so getting back to that too big to fail question, is there anything in the federal government's reactions during the course of the crisis that you think, once the crisis was underway and they were in the business of trying to arrange for Bear Stearns to be bought and trying to find someone to buy
right.
Lehman and shoring up AIG, do you think they should have done anything differently during that period? Should they have let Bear fail or... Should they have let Bear Stearns fail and not interceded?
I don't think so. I think that I don't think that would have helped matters. I think they should, as soon as Bear Stearns failed, they should have seriously they should have recognized how endangered the entire system was. They did very much the opposite. I think they intentionally wanted to test the system with Lehman Brothers. I can't blame I think acting under crisis is difficult, but it is very striking that once you get, you know, and as part of the thing I was saying about Geithner, in March, May, July of 2007, Bernanke insisted that the subprime crisis would not spread, as you know. That's part of the same dynamic I was discussing with the Fed. Neither the Washington Fed nor the New York Fed had any sense of how fragile securitization was. And perhaps that is the key historical point here, the key historical proof of how negligent their oversight was. They basically measured, like many economists, they basically measured how extensive the crisis would be by simply looking at the size of the subprime market, making some estimate that even if defaults went up to a certain amount, say 10%, it would only affect such and such amount of securities, with no understanding of how interlinked those securities were to collateralized debt obligations and other mortgage-backed securities, how leveraged the system was based on those subprime mortgages as collateral. And I find that just remarkable. Most of Wall Street didn't know either. Most Wall Street analysts, a few of the quote-unquote big shorts, seemed to figure it out. But the Fed has an advantage. They can go in and look at the books. They can demand some information, even if there might be some legal restraints. I believe they have the power to demand to take looks, and they didn't. Perhaps that's the single most glaring example or proof of the neglect of regulatory oversight, that they did not understand the web that was built around the subprime mortgages.
Right. Now, one of the perks of having subpoena power is you get to use it. Are there things that you don't know about the crisis that you wish you knew or think we should know?
Well, I think you don't need subpoena power to talk to the I guess maybe sometimes you do.
Yeah, sometimes they're
sorry.
So, sometimes they.
They don't tell you everything.
Yeah, no, they're not equal.
Well, I would love to know what they knew about the securitization process and whether they investigated it and whether they took credit rating agencies and investment bankers' word for these things. I would love to know that. I would love to know what I read you guys are perhaps going to issue subpoenas about, which is how explicitly the investment bankers understood that they were selling non-AAA rated securities as AAA rated securities, basically the CDOs. I would love to find that. I think all the information is in emails at the mid-level. Some of it may get to the top guys, but I think there has to be a treasure trove of emails at the mid-level of management in these investment banks and commercial banks. It's very hard for me to believe they did not know explicitly these were not AAA-rated securities. Well, if they did know they were not AAA-rated securities, is there some legal liability there?
Right.
Or at least, I don't know the law there, but I could imagine making a case. And I would love to know more about that. I think it's pretty much incumbent on you guys to get more information about that, because the system went down, basically, based on that, I believe, on that alone. I would love to know a little bit more about marking prices. Goldman Sachs has taken a lot of heat about marking down its CDOs and demanding collateral from AIG. But the other guys were refusing to mark down because it would mean they had to take big losses on their CDOs that they had on their books or in their or hidden away in their SIVs and so forth. I would love to find out more information about that. What went into the mark-to-market process? I'm not sure Golden was the bad guys, even though it was in their vested interest to mark down. They may have been marking down properly, and the other guys refusing to mark down improperly in the market. Those are a few areas I would love to know more about, and I don't know more about explicitly. I think they're pretty good, pretty interesting emails on the credit rating agency's decision-making process. But again, to me, the system came down on the basis of these collateralized debt obligations, and it was doubly endangered because of the mispricing of credit default swaps and derivatives, all of which were priced. That's part of the markdown process. Priced in obscurity. I mean, quite remarkable.
Right.
I'd like to say one other thing, if I can, to you guys. These markets are easy to manipulate. A hedge fund manager told me that his boss, a famous guy, I have this in a book that's coming out, but would never hire a hedge fund manager from Goldman Sachs. Now, this is, I'm getting the second hand, I have to be clear about that, because they have the entire market in front of them on the board. They know the flow of orders, the direction of orders. They can front run or at least co-run, so to speak, on securities. And I think this process is very given. I think the reason these guys make such big trading profits is that these markets are easy to front run. They're easy to push around. They're easy to, because a lot of the pricing is obscure or at least only semi-transparent. It's easy to make a little bit on big trades. You make enough of a little bit every day on very big trades, and you get very rich. And I'm very concerned that we don't have a handle on the markets.
I
don't know how you guys can deal with that, but
right. No, I
understand. Started the proprietary trading issue. When Paul Volcker talks about doing away with proprietary trading, I'm not quite clear what he means. Is it literally what they call proprietary trading, or is it trading, taking positions for their normal trading operations? And they make a lot of money and lose a lot of money trading, taking positions for their normal trading operations, but mostly they make a lot of money.
Right. Well, Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time out. I hope it would be okay if we called you if we had further questions.
Well, I'd love you to call.
Okay.
I want to say one last thing while I have you guys. I know you're dying for a cup of coffee.
No,
we're caffeinated. There is a theory in economics that, on average, profit rates, profitability can be high. But by firm, it would have to be variable. That is, some firms or some operations could do very, very well in some years, others poorly in some years. The average profit could be very high because the activities are risky. But the idea that firms make very high profits year in and year out is hard to justify in economic theory unless there are non-competitive or manipulative practices. And that isn't talked about enough. I suppose I should make that my final point.
Understood. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Good luck to you guys.
Okay.
If I can be of any help.
Okay, well, thank you. You're very kind. Thanks.
I would love to.
Thank you. Bye-bye.